You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brent Simpson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Amy Molloy.
Release day four. It's called Good Night, Beautiful. And I'll tell you what, Amy, what an amazing book. From page one, I was just sucked into the story. And
thank you.
I've thoroughly enjoyed it. And welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Amy, you know, you have such a fascinating story of getting to the place where you are now. And, you know, you were on the show a couple of years ago talking about your book, The Perfect Mother. And we talked a little bit about your journey up to that point. And you have some great stories along the way. But you did this TEDx talk maybe about 5 years ago, talking about how you broke into writing. And I rewatched it again, and it's just so fascinating and so funny the way that you talk about your journey. What was it that inspired you to? And I'll link that TEDx talk in the show notes so people can watch it and know what we're talking about. But you told about how you had no writing credits to your name, no history that people could, judge your work by. And you told about this journey to publishing this book, this first one, and then all of the opportunities that came after that. What was it that drove you in the beginning to know that you wanted to be a writer, even when, everything was stacked against you?
I was a big reader when I was a kid. It was just the thing that I did more than I did anything else. And, I was just drawn to it from a really young age. And, I was just always writing. I think most writers will say the same thing, but I was always writing, and I kept a journal for years that just every day I probably wrote in a journal. And, it's funny. We moved recently and I have my box of journals and I'm sort of taking small peeks at them. I think someday I might sit down and try and actually read through them. But what I wrote about mostly was about like this desire to write and a fear that I was never going to actually like have the courage to do it, or even just the knowledge of how to do it. This was a time like there was no internet and there was no Google and writing, there was no access to authors the way that there is now. And so I think it was just something that, was this like real passion for me and this desire to if I didn't do it, I had a weird career path where I ended up getting a master's in urban planning and moving to New York and, working this job that I hated. And I think I was always going to be unhappy if I didn't really give it my best shot. And so it was around turning 30, which, now I look back, I'm like, that was so young, but it doesn't feel young when you're going through it. And, it was for me, it was like this make or break moment. So that was when I stuck my toe into kind of nonfiction, which felt like an easier path into writing than fiction was. And, it would take me another 15 years before I really sat down and attempted a novel.
That first book with James Yee that you did, Forgotten Country, was an amazing achievement. And the story behind it is absolutely fascinating. And people can watch that that talk that you gave where you talk about your journey to that. But you talked about writing nonfiction and then your it took you a while to get to writing your own fiction. Did you see writing the nonfiction and helping other people tell their story? Did you see that as maybe a way to ease into, by helping other people tell their stories, you're not completely responsible for the story. Was that a way for you to segue, to transition in? And let me tag that question with this one. When you, you know, got in and writing nonfiction with other people, did you find that just as hard as writing fiction? You know, it seems like it would be easy because you're helping someone else tell their story. But that's not always the case, is it?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I did give this TED talk that sort of tells the long story of how I sort of got into nonfiction book writing. And for many years, I was a writer. So I was, you know, in nonfiction, it's very common that if you're somebody who has a story to tell, but you're not a writer, you will hire a person who is a writer, like me, to write the story. And then you will then say that you wrote the book, which is a really bizarre thing that happens all the time in publishing. And, you know, I did that for 15 years. And so I worked with a lot of, you know, some very famous people, some not very famous people, but, you know, very interesting people. And so it was this process, and every book was different, but it was, you know, I would sit down with the, with whoever the subject was and, you know, go very deep into their lives, enough that, you know, these books were really their people's memoir. And so I was ghostwriting people's memoirs, and some of it was amazing. It was very, people trusted me with so much stuff, and, you know, I entrusted me to like, to tell those stories. And in some ways it was a little bit frustrating because then the work wasn't really mine. It was, you know, it was theirs. And so, it was for me, it did teach me, I think, how to write. Cause before this, I had never taken a writing course. You know, my main education was just reading. And when I got my first book contract, which as you said, was with, an army captain named James Yee, who had served at Guantanamo. And it was one of the first inside looks of life at Guantanamo right after it opened. You know, it was the only, I went and got a lot of memoirs, and I just read a lot of memoirs to see how you do it. How do you pace it? And how do you build this arc? And, you know, I had no idea what I was doing. And so it was, you know, I learned to do it through writing books. And, you know, in some ways I feel very lucky because I was able to earn money kind of instead of, you know, kind of going to school and paying money. Like I was making money as a writer and I was learning so much about the craft and I was constantly reading. And so, yeah, I, you know, for me, like I feel like I needed to kind of do that to have the confidence to sit down and write a novel because, you know, if for anybody who's thinking about writing a novel or who's done it, like you can't actually, if you want to publish a novel, you have to write the entire novel first. And right. It's different with nonfiction. With nonfiction, you could sell a book on a 30-page proposal. But for writing a novel, you have to write the whole thing. And it has to be really good. Competing with like all these other writers. And so you have to get the attention of an agent who then has to get the attention of a publisher. So there's not a lot of room, you know, to kind of screw up. And so, you know, it took me a long time to kind of build that courage to sit down every day and keep writing, knowing that there was a chance that nobody would ever read what I was writing and that this was all a waste of time. You know, it wasn't going to be good when it was done. And every book that is published, basically, there's a person behind it who has to go through that every single day, you know, and face their demons and face their insecurities. And so, yeah, so I think all of that, you know, has led me to this where now I feel pretty comfortable like in being a novelist and writing novels and thinking about them, you know, after 20 years kind of working toward it.
When you published your first novel, The Perfect Mother, it was such a drastic departure from the work that you had been doing. And what a phenomenal book that is, by the way. But what was it like for you to make such a switch in the work that you were doing? Did The Perfect Mother come out of any particular situation, or is this just kind of a story that you'd been thinking about for a while and finally had the opportunity to work on it? What was the genesis of that project?
Yeah. I had my last book that I had ghostwritten. This is tricky because it was for somebody who eventually, like I wasn't very proud of the work. It was somebody, I mean, I have to be cagey about this, but it was somebody in politics who I eventually ended up feeling a lot of regret about working on their book. And so I think it was a time for me to kind of take a step back and, you know, kind of reframe like what I wanted to do. And really, it was more about, you know, that I was getting to feel more and more uncomfortable with the idea of putting somebody putting their name on a book that I had actually written. And, yeah. You know, the more experienced I got with it, the more I tried to negotiate that my name would be part of it. And a lot of people were, you know, pushing back on that and saying no. And I think that that was really what had happened. And so I had just had my second daughter pretty close, you know, within 2 years, I had two kids. And so I think it was this confluence of events of like not really wanting to kind of have somebody take credit for my work. And then having these little girls and wanting to kind of like show them the importance of having a voice. And so, you know, what I said to my husband was that the money that I had made from my last ghostwriting book, I was going to kind of claim as my own. And I was going to use it to, you know, to hire a babysitter and not take any ghostwriting jobs, but to work on a novel. And so, you know, and everybody had to be okay with it. Like the babies had to be okay with it. Husband had to be okay with it because this is what I was going to do. I was just going to, I was going to kind of claim 1 year to give a novel a try. And, you know, I think because I had just become a mother and, you know, the book is set in Brooklyn and it looks at new motherhood and, specifically about the expectations and the pressures around what's, you know, what you're supposed to do now that you're a woman who has a baby. And I wrote the book in a year and it was really looking back, like it was pretty easy for me because I think that I just didn't think anybody was ever going to read it. It was just going to be, you know, like I would force my husband to read it and my mother and they would be like, okay, cute. And then like, that would be it. you know, and so it was really freeing. I don't know if I'll ever have that experience again, but, and it ended up having this really weird success where I was able to, you know, get my dream agent and land at my dream publisher. And, you know, it was the book debuted at, on the New York Times bestseller list. And it was just nothing like I had ever anticipated. So, you know, and then it was good because I could finally say, and it was funny because actually in the middle of it, I had gotten, a call from an editor at Penguin with this ghostwriting job. And it was a great job. It was this female chef and she was super interesting and I love food. And I was really excited about this, but I was like, no, I can't do this. I can't start until January because that was my 1 year deadline for, you know, that I had given myself for the novel. And so that became this extra thing hanging over me because they agreed to let me wait. And then, you know, so I think I was supposed to start that job on January 15th and I sold the book, I think on like January 4th. And so I had to call them and say, I'm not going to do this book for you now because I'm doing this novel, which, you know, felt kind of like that was it. That was like, it was good. I was happy that I was able to kind of move, I think, into this new direction, hopefully more permanently.
I'm glad you talked about your journey as a ghostwriter and that decision that you finally had to make about what was right for you. Because while ghostwriting is absolutely a valid form of expression and a form of work for writers, absolutely. But there is that kind of dark side of you're always going to be tied to work that is not all about you, and that you know you have someone else's life that you're tied to, and you're not in control of the decisions that they make or what comes out later about, you know, the realities of their life or what, you know, whatever happens, that you're always kind of tied to someone else. Those are decisions that you have to weigh out when you become a ghostwriter, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I think ghostwriting is a fascinating thing that happens. And I think it's something that we don't understand how prevalent it is. And that, yeah. You know, basically most 95%, I would say, of famous people who publish books did not write that book. And it's weird to me that we think that just because like you're a famous whatever, that you know how to write a memoir. Like writing a book is a really specific skill that is, you know, like pretty hard most of the time and very unenjoyable. So it's not something that somebody can just like sit down and whip out their, you know, like write down this memoir. And so, but we, for some reason, we have agreed to accept this idea that there are writers who are unnamed and work without credit, you know, and then other people who then say like, no, I wrote this book, you know, don't get me wrong. Like some books I got paid very well for, like there are, you could make a good living doing this. And so I'm sure. Certainly not, like, you know, you know what you're getting into, but I do think it would be a better system if ghostwriters were given credit, and, you know, some of them are, and but yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, whatever happens with, you know, with that book and, you know, that person, then you write it, you hand it off, then that person kind of runs with it. And again, for most of the time, you know, I wrote this book called Janssen's Gift with a woman named Pam Cope, who is now just like my sister, a sister to me. And, you know, she was not famous. Her story is that she lost her son unexpectedly when he was a teenager, and she ended up kind of using her grief to, you know, to work with kids in West Africa who had been sold into slavery, and to, you know, rescue them. And she now runs this incredible complex in Ghana where kids are educated, and, you know, she has rescued hundreds of kids. And, you know, her story, I think, is just like a beautiful gift in her book. It's just one of my favorite books ever. You know, and so most of it was just, it's really a privilege, to really work with people and to be able to tell their story. But I do think it's tricky with, you know, some people that there could be, you know, we could kind of be more open about giving credit to writers in those situations.
Papyrus Author was designed and developed with the modern writer's needs, wishes, and preferences in mind. From big structures right down to tiny details, every single feature of our software has been carefully and meticulously crafted in collaboration with authors. Take charge of your writing with the author interface, which gives you access to different elements of your story, such as characters' backgrounds and narrative structure. Move sections of your writing seamlessly in the navigator and evaluate the complexity of your text with our expert style and readability analysis. Never worry about losing progress with automated backups. With Papyrus Author, you can be your own writer, editor, and publisher. The world of writing is about to change. Papyrus Author, the word processor for authors, has arrived on the international stage, unrivaled in its scope. It is the first software suite to unite every single step of creative writing. The vision behind Papyrus Author is to empower everyone with an idea to turn it into a great book for free. A word processing core that matured for over 10 years at its foundation, Papyrus Author goes beyond the text with its intuitive organizing layers for story, characters, notes, and research. The powerful style and readability analysis help raise manuscript quality. The inbuilt publication capabilities take the book directly to the reader with ebooks, DocX, and print-ready PDF. Visit papyrusauthor.com to get started today. Do you want to get paid to write stories? Do you enjoy collaborating with other talented storytellers? Do you want to work completely remotely and set your own hours? Relay Publishing is looking for writers and editors to work on fiction projects across a range of genres, from thrillers to sci-fi, fantasy, and romance. The Relay process is extremely collaborative, in the same vein as a TV show's writer's room. If you're a story geek, then you'll be on a great team. There are 7 ghostwriting positions and 10 editing positions currently available. Please go to www.recruitment.relaypub.com. That's www.recruitment.relaypub.com for more information on how to apply. Join a great storytelling team today. For sure. Amy, you talked about when you were writing The Perfect Mother, this feeling of freedom, my words, not yours, that you felt in writing this book, and that, you know, this was going to be your project, but no one was expecting it. you know, maybe your husband was going to read it, your mother, and, you know, everybody would have a good time with it. But there was no pressure on the book. When you turned that book in and, you know, sold it and, you know, realized that, OK, this is going to be a thing, on the other side of that first draft life where the book then goes into editing and, you know, you're dealing with a publisher who's going to, you know, ask you to make some adjustments here and there. And, you know, the process that we all go through in taking that book from our computer to published life. Did you find that process different when you turned in your novel than when you turned in a ghostwriting job? Was it different and was it difficult on the other side of that initial writing process?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, probably only in that I didn't have as much of an investment in the ghostwriting that I was doing. So if the editor was like, you should change this, I was usually like, okay, you know, and whoever I was working with kind of would have a strong opinion about that sometimes. But I mean, my editor at Harper is a woman named Jennifer Barth, and she's really good, and she has made my books so much better. And so I'm really happy to have her input on stuff. And you know, so I think it's good. I think there's this misconception that I hear often that editors no longer edit, and I haven't found that to be true. You know, I think Jennifer she's very good at seeing the flaws and, you know, seeing like the weird things I do in my writing that just weighs down the prose. And so I am really always happy to put in it. And I'm lucky in that way.
I can't remember when we talked last time because The Perfect Mother was just coming out. But Kerry Washington has attached herself that this is coming to the big screen. Where is that in the world right now?
I don't know. I think everything has sort of been put on hold with this virus. So
yeah.
They had the option for a while. So I'm still hoping. I would love to see what she does with the story, but I don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Amy, after The Perfect Mother and you launched, you know, your novel writing career and everyone loves the book and it's a huge success, then Goodnight Beautiful comes out. When did this story idea come to you?
For Goodnight Beautiful. Yeah. It is actually a funny story. So,
that's okay.
I never know how to turn these off, but so, I had been living in New York and this was probably 15 years ago. And I had decided that I wanted to, start to see a therapist, and it was completely like out of normal. Like I was raised Irish Catholic. Like you don't go to therapy. You just kind of deal, you know,
you're right. Grind through it.
Everything's going to be fine. And so I went to an acquaintance of mine named Mark, who is a therapist. And I said to him, how do you find a therapist? And he said, you should go to my therapist. She's amazing. This woman named Judith. And so I went to Judith and I said to her, you know, like, Mark, you know me. I assume this is not going to matter because he will never come up in therapy for me. Like, he's just some guy I know. And she was like, no, it's fine. Don't worry about it. And then 3 years later, I start to like have a real crush on Mark. And so we were still seeing the same therapist. And so I had this idea at the time that I would like on the way out one day, like hide in a closet and just listen in on his therapy sessions to see if he was talking about me, to see if he, you know, also was saying that he liked me. And of course I never did it, but I really wanted to do it. And so we eventually started dating. And I said, you know, I told him the story that I was like, oh yeah, I always wanted to hide in the closet to see if you were talking about me. And, you know, and we were like, oh, wouldn't that be a funny idea for a novel? And so, you know, I remember like, we would be like, oh yeah, this is what would happen. And it's like, it was this cleaning person who was like hiding in a closet at a therapy office. And we had this whole thing about this novel, and I was not writing fiction at the time. And so fast forward, you know, now 20 years later, and Mark and I are married with two children, and he is still a therapist. And after I wrote The Perfect Mother, I went back and said, do you remember that idea we had about somebody listening in on therapy sessions? And, you know, like, what could I do with that? And I started to kind of just play around with that idea of like a woman listening in on a husband's therapy sessions based on that. So, and what is actually quite funny is that, you know, the book in the Good Night Beautiful, Sam is the therapist, and him and his wife, Annie, leave New York and they move to the country, and he has a home office. And there's a vent through which everything can be heard upstairs. And so what's funny is that we have since moved to the country, and Mark used to go and, you know, commute to New York a couple of days a week to keep his practice. But since the virus, he has actually been working in the basement, seeing patients over Zoom. And there is actually a vent in our house through which I can now, if I wanted to, listen in on his therapy sessions. So I promise I don't. But it is very funny how we've kind of come full circle with this.
That's hilarious. to see real life seeping into a novel. So you have that idea, but when did these characters kind of walk onto the stage? So you've got this idea, and, you know, wouldn't that be funny? And oh, I could see how this would happen. But when did the story embody these characters?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's also, it's a hard book to talk about because there's some pretty big twists in it that are, you know, it's hard, you don't want to give away. But the process with Good Night Beautiful is that after The Perfect Mother came out, I had written about 100 pages. And so we decided to take those to the publisher and to Jennifer, to my editor, and she liked it. She liked this idea. And the book was called The Hiding Place at the time. And it was a similar premise. It was a husband and wife. They moved to the country. The wife is upstairs listening in on the husband's therapy sessions. And so I sold the book on 100 pages, but, you know, I still had 200 pages to write. And so I sat down and I had 6 months or something to finish it. And a couple weeks before the book was due, I was really struggling with it. I just thought it was like, it was not what I wanted for my second novel. It felt very quiet and not really original. And I had this idea pop into my head for one of the characters, who I won't mention who, so I don't spoil it for anybody. And it was a rethinking of the book. Same premise. It was still a husband and wife who moved the country, and they're still listening in on the therapy session. But everything was sort of shifted. And I think part of this is that at the time, the wife, her name was Bess, now it's Annie, but she was a little hysterical, and she wasn't totally believable. And you were not supposed to know, like, what, you know, she was this very unreliable narrator. And Me Too was happening, and it was kind of growing and gaining importance. And there was I was thinking a lot about this idea of the fact that so many women are not believed. And I was struggling really a lot with writing this character who was like another woman who we were, you know, telling people she couldn't be believed. And like, is she crazy, or what's her problem? And is she telling the truth, or is she not? And I think, like, living through Me Too and writing this character just started to feel very unsettling to me. And so this idea popped into my head of literally a character popped into my head. And so I was 3 weeks away from turning the book in. It was, I mean, we had a cover, we had like every, we had a publication date. And I remember I emailed my agent, and Elizabeth Weed, who I love. And I was like, hey, just hypothetically speaking, if you sell a book and you're 3 weeks away from the deadline, and you decide that you have a better idea, but it's going to require basically throwing out this book and rewriting it, like, is that okay? And like, she didn't get back to me, you know? And so 2 hours later, I was like texting her. I was like, hey, I think we need to talk. And I was like, maybe this is like, you know, and I kept being like, pushed out of my head. It's not gonna, I can't do this. And then by like 4, I had her on the phone, and I was like, okay, big problem. And, you know, and that was on a Friday. And then by Monday, we were at lunch with Jennifer, and we were presenting this new idea to her and saying, like, this is a better book, and this is, you know, a bigger book. And she was incredibly gracious and generous. And she said, okay, you know, I'm going to trust that you know what you're doing. And she gave her and Harper gave me another year to finish it. And so you know, I had to like go back and I literally threw away that book and like started over with these different characters. And, you know, I don't regret it. It was a lot of work. I mean, if I had known, it meant that I was going to publish this like during a pandemic, like before 2 weeks election, I probably would have rethought it. But I do think that it was the right move.
One thing that I find fascinating is you talk about the character of Annie, and you said at the time she, you know, had a different name. She was, did you say Beth or Beth?
Yeah.
Is a character more than a name? You know, when they're on the page, when you're writing them, do they become fully formed people? Because you know, when you talk about them, you know, this character used to be called this, but it sounds like she's a completely different character. Like, does the name, is it more than just that? Do they become completely different people? And I don't feel like I'm getting the gist of my question, but it sounds like you're talking about real people, and that just because you change their name doesn't mean you change them, but it sounds like they're different. They live differently on the page.
Yeah, totally. And these were very different characters. Like, you know, it really was like throwing away this one character and writing a different one. Because like Annie, you know, who is in Goodnight Beautiful, like, and I mean, it is weird because I do talk about her like she's real, but like, I mean, she's, you know, she's super smart and she's really independent and bullheaded and she knows what she wants and like she doesn't put up with anybody's bullshit. And you know, and this, my other character was the opposite of that. You know, she was kind of like weak and you know, like afraid of like losing her husband, and you know, and I really kind of, I think, turned the whole, you know, a lot of wanting to throw this away was like I didn't really want to write that character. Like she wasn't that interesting to me, and she felt like she was just like you've read her before. You've read the desperate woman who's afraid of her husband leaving. And, you know, what ended up emerging was the Annie Potter who's in Goodnight Beautiful, you know, and she's, you know, she's married to Sam, and he is this very, you know, kind of alluring and charming and handsome doctor. And, you know, but she's not afraid of losing him. It's actually the opposite. Like she, when they first meet, she's like, I promise, like, I will only give you 6 months. Like, that's all I will offer. Like, don't get your hopes up that this is going to be a long-term thing. Cause I don't do that because men are pretty boring, you know? And like Sam is, you know, sort of determined to kind of change her mind because he's really, really likes her. And so it kind of, I think, flips a lot of like the gender stereotypes on its head. And you know, and they have this, Sam and Annie have this weekly tradition of they celebrate their anniversary every week. And you kind of assume, I think, that that's her idea. And then you find out that it's actually his because he's so excited that like he has her, that he just wants to celebrate like another week of marriage with her. And so, yeah, it was, you know, I'm names are hard for me. I think like I can write for a while, even this book, I'm working on something now and I don't actually know her name. And, you know, I think it has to, I spent a lot of time on nameberry.com, like, is, you know, how to name your baby. And, you know, I kind of scroll through that for a while to try and see if something sticks out for me, but name, I find names to be kind of hard.
One thing that I found really interesting is in, you know, looking at the Amazon page for the book, Goodnight Beautiful, someone said from Master of Clever Misdirection, Amy Molloy. How do you feel about being kind of getting this reputation for being a master of clever misdirection?
I don't know. It's a little weird that I do that. Like my husband's like, you know, but yeah, I sort of enjoy that. I think like kind of like tricking readers and, you know, playing a lot with people's assumptions. So I don't know.
Well, and you do it from the very beginning, from the very beginning in chapter one, that is a misdirection that resolves pretty quickly. And you let the reader into that first chapter, and it's kind of a funny misdirection. But yet it kind of sets the stage for what is coming for the rest of the book.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think that it's kind of fun with that because, you know, I feel like if you read that chapter closely, like there's a lot of hints in there that will right. eventually sort of play out in a bigger way throughout the book. So that was, I mean, that first, it was that first scene that sort of, you know, I think that sort of spurred me to write the book was like the idea of leading a reader down a path and then like switching it pretty quickly in the first chapter was like something that was pretty fun to do.
What, you know, it's become very popular in thrillers and especially, you know, domestic thrillers or psychological thrillers to sort of take this Gillian Flynn, you know, note of the unreliable narrator and, you know, pulling the rug out from under readers. And when done cheaply and, you know, you can only pull off that sort of trick so many times before the readers just kind of roll their eyes and, you know, it's a, well, there was that trick again. But you don't allow us to let our guard down enough to get caught up by these easy tricks. How is it that you, keep us guessing and keep, moving the story around so that it does feel natural and it feels fresh each time you do it. Do you ever worry about, you know, coming up against what's popular in fiction right now? And how do you steer away from, you know, just your writing becoming cliche, even though, it still is jarring for the reader. How do you keep that fresh?
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's a nice compliment, but I don't know. And I think I write a book and then I throw it away because that was how I felt, you know, and that was actually like the exact problem that I had with that first version of this book was that to me, it felt like the same version of, you know, 20 other books that would be published, you know, this time. And, I don't know, you know, and I think that it could have worked. You know, I think like there are readers who like to kind of have these experiences of, you know, like kind of trying to figure stuff out and, you know, figuring out some of it, not other parts of it. But I think that I was a little just worried about, I think, getting pigeonholed in my own head that this is the kind of writer that I was going to be and that this was going to be my career. And I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, when I took my first ghostwriting job in 2003, I thought this is going to be a great project to do for, you know, for the next year and a half. And I ended up doing it for 15 years, you know, and my agent at the time, I kept saying to her, like, I would like to write a novel. And she was like, but you're a ghostwriter. And so, and I was young and inexperienced and, you know, and I was like, you're right. And I think I want to avoid that wherever my career takes me in the next, however many years, like 20 years, you know, I want to be very careful about not having my own expectations that I'm a certain type of writer and that that's what I'm going to have to produce. And I think that, you know, I'm doing some interviews and people are like, you know, why are you a thriller writer? And I'm like, I don't think I'm a thriller writer. Like I'm no more a thriller writer than I am a nonfiction writer or a ghost writer. It's just, that's what these two books have been. So, you know, I don't know. I think that a third book feels, that's a really important time in possibly like in a novelist's life because it's, I think the time where you have some, I don't know. It's like you're at a crossroads here. Like, are you gonna keep going in one direction? Or are you gonna kind of take a risk and try something else? And I think that I might be leaning towards trying something else. So, well, and probably because of that, I don't want to be known as the master of clever misdirection for the next 15 years. Like, you know, I would like to see what else I could do.
Well, to be known as that for right now is pretty exciting. And I love everything that you're doing. Good Night Beautiful is available everywhere today. Go grab your copy, Kindle edition, hardback, audiobook. There are links to all of those in the show notes where you can grab them. Amy, if people are just, you know, learning about you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you do, where can they find you online?
Well, I have a website, amymalloy.com. And I'm at Instagram at AmyMalloy718, where I like to post photographs of tomatoes and stuff.
Great. We'll put links to those in the show notes as well. Good night, beautiful. Go grab your copy today. Amy, thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show.
Thank you, Hank. So nice to talk to you.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates. PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web.
You ever wonder if a person's critical thinking comes at the expense of their own happiness? Is it possible to be very happy and still practice excellent discernment? I used to wonder the same thing. Then I discovered the Trouble in Paradise podcast with Nigel Kent and Jasmine Starr, where they laugh as well as think about conspiracy theories and unexplained phenomena, without ever getting bogged down in the age-old tug-of-war between logic and feeling. The Trouble in Paradise podcast is a joyful program for critical thinkers who have a sense of humor. Join Nigel and Jasmine as they probe the intriguing and wacky culture of odd occurrences, strange news, and ridiculous coincidences on this hilariously intelligent podcast. Trouble in Paradise on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Stitcher. Follow at tipcast239 on Twitter. Trouble in Paradise with Nigel Kinn and Jasmine Starr, a happy podcast for critical thinkers like you.